From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. NPR has confirmed that 2 days after the November election, former President Obama warned President Trump against hiring Michael Flynn as his national security advisor. Months later, President Trump would say he had no knowledge of concerns. And today, former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates is expected to tell lawmakers that in January, she also expressed alarm to a White House lawyer that Michael Flynn's contacts with Russians left him in a compromised position and that he misrepresented those contacts to Trump transition officials. She was soon fired from her position for her opposition to President Trump's travel ban, which is also in court today. And health care reform is on the Senate agenda this week. So big week. Let's bring in NPR politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
And start with the warning. What do you make of this warning by former President Obama to President Trump? And remember, Obama had fired Michael Flynn from his White House.
That's correct. And our understanding is that this was based on Flynn's role as the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency when he had been fired. And President Trump, a White House official, a former White House official, confirms, had warned President Trump during that Oval Office meeting about his track record. Now, the White House, according to other reports, is responding, saying that the president, basically confirming this, saying that while the president has never divulged the details of that conversation, Obama made the president aware that he was not a fan of Michael Flynn. But then they go on to say that why would he, given that Flynn was critical of Obama? So instead of taking this as a good faith warning, they're taking it as political.
Well, and this becomes interesting as well because the Trump administration had been sort of blaming President Obama for Flynn's being hired by the Trump administration because they said Obama vetted him at one point.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, the White Houses don't give security clearances. Security clearances are given by those agencies. So, you know, Flynn had been obviously within the Pentagon for quite some time, got those clearances, but then his management style landed him in hot water with the Obama administration and the people who worked for him. And apparently now the former president Obama had warned the incoming president, Donald Trump.
Well, so what do we expect to hear from Sally Yates today?
So Sally Yates today, I think Democrats want to hear what she's going to have to say as far as what she warned the White House about with Michael Flynn. She says, according to published reports earlier this year, that he lied about the content of his conversation with the Russian ambassador. She said that because of that, Flynn could be subjected to blackmail from the Russian government. So Democrats will likely want to get her on the record about that. And Republicans, on the other hand, will want to hear what she has to say about how that information was leaked. Now, remember that that the White House didn't do anything about Michael Flynn for weeks until it became public. There was no indication that President Trump was willing to fire Michael Flynn. He's defended him all throughout. He called this a witch hunt at one point, and he apparently, according to some reports over the weekend, has been admonishing members of his own staff to stop saying bad things about Flynn, so to an extent still defending Flynn.
And we reminded that Sally Yates was fired from her job, interim attorney general, because she backed the court ban on President Obama's travel ban on people from six Muslim-majority countries. There's a court hearing this afternoon on the president's ban. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals is taking what's seen as an extraordinary step of going straight to a full court hearing, televising it on C-SPAN. What's expected to come from
that's
that?
That's right. Yeah, and it goes even further than that with Sally Yates. You know, she refused to defend the president's travel ban, which was seen as insubordinate by President Trump. As far as today's hearing, you know, you've got these two sides of it where you have, again, advocates for the refugee for refugees coming to the United States, saying that President Trump's intent here was to ban Muslims because, and using his own words against him from the campaign when he said that we have to stop Muslims from coming in the United States until we figure out what's going on. And the on the other side of that, the Justice Department is countering, saying that the president enjoys sweeping authority at the border when it comes to national security and that the language was tempered and that this has nothing to do with Muslims.
Yeah, and just
but,
to,
of course, this is not going to be the last word and likely headed right for the Supreme Court.
Well, and just briefly, speaking about not the last word, we know that Senate Republicans, including Maine's Susan Collins, have said they're not going to use the House Republican health care plan that passed last week. They're going to start from scratch. Talk about that division in Congress over where the Republicans head.
Absolutely. And they are absolutely going to start over. We're talking about things like Medicaid expansion, pre-existing conditions, still the main centerpieces. I was really struck, and you can see now that it was not much more than a sugar high with President Trump in the Oval, in the Rose Garden. It reminded me more of something like a team pouring Gatorade on a coach after a field goal kicker kicked a field goal in the first quarter.
Ouch. You hate when that happens.
Never seen that before.
Right, mistaken Gatorade. Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, South Korea elects a new president tomorrow. The winner will replace Park Geun-hye, who was impeached and formally removed from office in March. She's in jail now, awaiting trial on charges that include bribery, extortion, and abuse of power. The election comes amid escalating tensions with North Korea, which just announced the detention of another American citizen. Joining us from Seoul, South Korea, the BBC's Steve Evans. And Steve, we'll get to the election in just a minute, but what do we know about this latest American, the fourth American, to be detained by the North?
We only have information that's come through the North Korean authorities, and they say that this man was detained recently for activities hostile to the state. Well, hostile to the state can cover an awful lot of ground. What's odd about it is that it's the second detained U.S. citizen within 2 weeks. So there are now four U.S. citizens arrested and held in North Korea. So you wonder if it's connected with the current tension, the current standoff, verbal standoff between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. You remember a few days ago, North Korea said that it had uncovered an assassination plot against Kim Jong-un, organized by the CIA and South Korean intelligence. Now, it was quite a bizarre allegation with details that didn't quite match up. But you wonder if American citizens are being arrested, perhaps to be used as bargaining chips later. He seems, Mr. Kim seems to have a Christian background, and that would be something which if he, let's say he left a Bible around or something like that, if you do that in North Korea, you get arrested and you do a lot of hard labor.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that story, but let's talk about the election coming up in South Korea. First of all, who are the top contenders?
There are 13 candidates all told, right across the political spectrum. But really, there's one man, if you believe the polls. And as you know, in the US, the polls don't always predict the election results. But if you believe the polls, the man who's going to win is a guy called Moon Jae-in. And he comes from the center-left Democratic Party. He's so far ahead in the polls that it would be a real upset if he didn't win. But, you know, elections are only won when they're won. He's an interesting character because his policy is to talk to Pyongyang. He was last in government, involved in government, under what's called the Sunshine Era. And that was a time when the policy of Seoul was to communicate and cooperate with Pyongyang. There were joint industrial ventures, for example, where South Korean companies would make things in North Korea with North Korean workers, paying North Korean wages, actually. All that ended with President Obama in Washington and President Park in Seoul, the previous president, whose policy was ever tougher sanctions and no communication. So if Mr. Moon wins, then that would be a big change in policy. And it could be a change of policy that put tension between Washington and Seoul.
Is the issue of North Korea the big issue in the election, or are people voting on the economy and other things?
Well, they're certainly voting on the economy. And certainly if you ask young people, they say, we don't remember the Korean War, nor do we remember the poverty that followed it, the no rice days as they had following the Korean War 60 years ago, more than 60 years ago. For them, they say it's economic security. And what they mean by that is knowing they're going to get a job. Now, security in terms of the North is always there, and how you play that is always there. And I think it is now playing with more a little bit more skepticism about the Americans and about things like THAAD, the anti-missile system, which has just been installed hastily by the U.S. military in South Korea. And the administration in Washington probably didn't help matters by saying that South Korea pay for it or pay more for it, because people in South Korea said, hold on a minute, we thought the deal was we provide the land and that was the deal. But security concerning North Korea is a factor. It's the constant backdrop. But it's economic issues which seem to be getting to people in the day-to-day campaigning.
That's the BBC's Steve Evans joining us from Seoul. Steve, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And now for a David and Goliath business story. When you think of English muffins, you probably think of one brand.
Note the nooks and crannies. They make Thomas's crispier and crunchier than yours.
And light and airy, too.
Precisely.
137 years ago, in 1880, Samuel Bath Thomas invented the English muffin at his New York bakery. And today, hundreds of millions of Thomas's English muffins are sold each year. Well, a startup called Stone and Skillet is trying to change that. 3 years ago, co-owners Dan Carruthers and Kyle Meekins started making English muffins in their apartment. Now they're churning out tens of thousands a week and selling them across the Northeast and perhaps soon across the nation. I visited Kyle and Dan at their Massachusetts bakery. We're in Medford.
Yes.
Outside of Boston.
Yeah.
This is, looks unassuming. I wouldn't even know this was a bakery.
It is. This used to be a pizza shop, actually, for a long time. Before that, it was a catering shop. When we started off, we weren't making very many English muffins, and we kind of came in here and did what we could with the infrastructure, then made it an open floor plan. So now it's a fully functioning muffin factory, making 40,000 muffins a week by hand right now, out of 750 square feet. So it's come a long way since a pizza shop.
All the Stone and Skillet muffins come from here?
For the most part, almost everything we do is based out of here. And the nice thing about having a pizza shop was that no one's ever made these things this way before, so we kind of created it, so we were able to form it into almost exactly what we needed it to be.
Wow. All right, well, let's take a look inside.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
We walk up the flour-covered steps into the kitchen. There are four or five people working the dough, cooking, and packing muffins, four per bag.
If you just kind of look around, you can kind of stand in the middle of the bakery and just do a 360 and get a sense of how everything's done. Right over here, we're standing next to the mixer, which mixes the dough. And then it goes over to the portioning station, which basically you're just taking the dough, turning it into dough balls. So what we do after they're formed into these 3-ounce dough balls, we put them on sheet trays lined with cornmeal. And we proof them, which means that you're allowing the yeast to kind of rise and do its thing. So after it doubles in size, we bring it over to where this is kind of the secret sauce of the whole operation is, we flat top griddle them instead of ovens. And that's what gives it that kind of nice golden brown top and bottom. It kind of fries up the cornmeal a little bit, too. So it adds a nice, texture and aesthetic to the product, too.
How long from the moment that you start and put the flour in the mixer to the moment it's ready to be purchased?
Probably about 12 to 15 hours.
Yeah. That's it?
That's it.
Wow.
We kind of keep this whole old New England style theme going. You know, all of our machinery is really basic bakery machinery. Our dough divider was made in East Germany, if that tells you how old it is.
Wow.
And
can I see the dough divider?
Sure.
Yeah. It's pretty cool, actually. So,
R2-Dough 2.
Yeah.
R2-Dough 2. It does look like
we were going to color it. R2-D2. We were going to paint it. We were extremely ambitious when we first got it, but the orders start coming in, so we didn't have enough time. But basically what you do is you take these 7-pound dough heads, is what they're called, and you put them on these plates, and you kind of pat it out into a circle, and then you bring this thing down, it cuts it, and then this plate spins it, and in a minute Jose will show you how it's done. It's pretty cool, actually. This is every single muffin is made in this thing.
How did you find that?
We found it on Craigslist, and it's a workhorse. It's been working for us for as long as we've been here.
R2-Dough 2.
R2-Dough 2.
We've had that thing since we started. Before we started with that, Dan and I, we worked overnight in a couple of our friends' restaurants, and we rolled every single one of them out by hand. So we'd literally be doing thousands of muffins a night, rolling them out, cutting them to the exact weight, putting them on the grill, packaging them by hand, and doing a little twist tie.
Good way to get
out the door. Yeah.
So Jose's patting this out right now, and we'll show you how it goes into the machine here. A little flour on top so it doesn't stick.
R2-D2, hard at work. So, how did these guys have success in a business that has had one dominant player for so long? So, one of the things about your muffins is that they are very different from the muffins, the English muffins that we all know and have known forever, the Thomas English muffins. What's different about them?
Well, I think the biggest difference in our muffins compared to a Thomas's is the way that it's made. Again, it's all handmade, and they don't see any ovens. They're flat-top griddled, so it gives it a nice golden brown top and bottom.
Tastes kind of like a donut.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's almost like a savory donut. What's nice about kind of griddling them on the flat tops is you get that fried cornmeal, but you also get kind of crispy top and bottom and like the nice soft pillowy inside too. So there's a lot of different textures going on there. So that, I think, is the biggest thing that differentiates us from the English muffins that, you know, most people are used to.
Do you see Thomas as your main competition?
We're kind of in a class of our own. You know, we're something a little bit more premium. You know, there's nothing wrong with Thomas's or any other of those English muffins, but right now we're kind of we're doing our own thing.
Well, you're not known for your nooks and crannies, which
No. Yeah. We don't do nooks and crannies. Yeah.
Why not? Well,
we like a dense product because what that does is it allows us to apply it to more culinary applications, you know, like burgers, sandwiches, pizzas. It's really good for croutons. You can do a lot of stuff with it. French toast, really good.
Hmm. Why did you decide to get into the English muffin business?
So, I had the idea when I was working for another artisan bakery as a salesman. Dan was a chef in Boston, and we had a lot of mutual chef friends. And every time I went to try to make a bread sale, they would say, "Hey, do you guys have any English muffins?" And I'd go back to my boss, and he'd say, "Oh, we don't make them. That's not really baking. It's kind of this in-between cooking and baking." I came to Dan, and I said, "We have our chef friends. They're curing their own back bacon. They're poaching their eggs in champagne vinegar, and they're putting it on Thomas's English muffin. And it's not necessarily the right application for them. So let's create the best English muffin in the world and see what happens."
I know that one of the big moments for you was when Whole Foods decided to carry your muffins. How did you get that to happen?
So we were at the Boston Food Festival, and we brought what we thought was enough product for the whole 5-6 hour event. And we ultimately ended up running out in an hour. But while we were there, somebody came up to me and said, "Are you guys in Whole Foods?" And I said, "No, you know, we've always thought we should be, but we're not." And he said, "That's because you haven't met me yet." And he ended up being one of the local foragers. And within a few months, we were in every Whole Foods in New England and kind of took off from there.
And now expanding.
Yeah, we've expanded out to the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut Whole Foods. And we're in discussions with the Mid-Atlantic region and the Rocky Mountain region as well.
Now, no offense to this space, but you're not going to be able to stay in here much longer,
no,
are you?
No way. No. It's the walls are closing in. And we're actively looking for much larger spaces in and around Boston. We want to stay in Boston because it's our hometown, and we kind of claim that old New England style, so it's part of the brand. But, you know, we're actively looking for more automation, something that keeps the integrity of the product, but also is able to supply the demand that we're starting to recognize nationally.
I know you've been looking at a very expensive machine.
Yeah, they're really expensive. Bakery production machines are extremely expensive, but I mean, they pay for themselves, you know, over in a year. But this one in Germany particularly, took us about 3 years to find this, and it pumps out 4,500 muffins an hour. And currently
Wow.
We're doing 400, maybe 500 on a good day.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going to tell me that the biggest purchase I'd ever make in my life was a machine that would make English muffins, I wouldn't have believed you. Mm. But it's, you know, it's more than the majority of people's homes cost. So we're working our way towards it.
How many people do you employ right now?
We employ about 25 to 30, all said and done.
And do you think that as you expand, you're going to employ more people?
Absolutely. It's such a labor-intensive process. We have to find people who care just like we do, and we've been lucky to do that. But since we make these things by hand, it's a human process. And even when we bring in other machinery, it's going to continue to be, because we want to monitor that quality.
What's the biggest failure that you've experienced along the way?
Wow. How much time do you have? We grew too rapidly. We brought on people on our team really quickly. We ramped up for projected sales that didn't hit as quickly as we thought they would. And then we backed off and the sales hit, right? So it's just this, when you're growing, you're always trying to find the right ratio of growth to kind of profit.
What would you say, biggest failure?
That's pretty much what I would say. Yeah, just kind of balancing the act of accommodating the growth that's coming in, where we're not putting the company financially at risk, is quite a dance that we're working on and we're learning and we're getting better every day at.
Well, so many businesses like yours don't end up making it. They fail at some point. Are you still worried about that, or you think you've gotten over that hurdle?
Well, I mean, they say it's the first 18 months and then, you know, you're in the clear, but I can tell you that that is not the case. You're always at risk.
So do you think in 5 years, if we were to talk to you, you'll be bigger than Thomas?
We hope so. Yeah, I mean, that'd be great.
He's got a 100-year head start, so the goal is to ultimately grow this into what we know what we can be.
That's Kyle Meekins and Dan Carruthers, co-founders of Stone and Skillet. Guys, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
And if you want to see R2-D2, we've got a video from inside the bakery at hereandnow.org.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott has signed a controversial law that bans sanctuary cities in his state. Now, essentially, sanctuary cities mean the local police don't detain undocumented people without a warrant from federal immigration officials. Here's Governor Abbott speaking yesterday.
Now, this law can lead to jail time and removal from office for any official who refuses to comply with the ban on sanctuary cities.
Joining us now from Austin is Ben Philpott, senior editor at Here and Now contributor KUT. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
If I can't get through that, how am I going to get through what I'm about to do? I want to tell you what Austin's Mayor Steve Adler told us in April. He said there are two requests that can come from ICE, you know, federal officials. One is a warrant for someone's detention. The other is a civil request to hold on to someone till ICE can get them, a warrantless request. And Mayor Adler said he talked to Attorney General Sessions, who told him that second warrantless request is voluntary. Police, local police don't have to comply. So what does the Texas law say about all this?
Yeah, the Texas law now says that you do have to comply with each and every ICE detainer request. And if you don't, the police chief or the sheriff could be fined and possibly removed from office. Making those optional requests mandatory is probably going to be part of what we assume will be legal challenges coming here in the next few weeks and months before the law goes into effect in September. But beyond that, the law doesn't change a whole lot. Even one of the bill's authors has said that he can't name a sanctuary city in Texas. So Democrats and Hispanic advocates have said that if that's the case, then the bill is about race and not law, and they're worried about an increase in racial profiling.
When you talk about this going to court, we know a federal judge turned down President Trump's ban on sanctuary cities. He wanted to cut funding to those cities. That was turned down. So we'll see what happens in the legal channels. But we know there were protests outside the governor's mansion last night and opposition from police leaders in the state. Remind us why.
Well, they fear that this law will keep people from reporting crimes because of fear of being deported. Of course, opponents have said, again, that this is a show-me-your-papers law, which will have people afraid to leave their homes and, of course, afraid to have any interaction with police.
Well, and this is why most cities say they have become sanctuary cities, because their local police say they can't do policing in neighborhoods where people are afraid of them. It's one thing for them to be afraid of federal officials, but when you're talking about local police, that's why they don't want to get involved. So, what other sentiment are you hearing there?
Well, there's obviously anger from different groups that have been opposing this bill throughout the session. We've had protests starting last night and throughout into the morning and today now in front of the governor's mansion. There have been multiple press conferences and conference calls with different groups talking about how they will now go ahead and fight this law before it goes into effect in September. But it is interesting that the governor did it with a Facebook Live video last night, not just because there was then nobody there. There were no chance to ask him questions, and kind of a muted way to roll out the bill than the normal one with, all the lawmakers standing behind him, shaking hands and being excited about the bill.
So we'll keep an eye on this. Ben Philpott, senior editor at Here Now, contributor KUT in Austin, Texas. Ben, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Senate Republicans like Susan Collins of Maine are saying they're not even going to use the House Republican health care plan passed with great fanfare last week when they begin shaping their own bill to repeal and replace Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, this week. But it's still worth taking a look at the House Republican plan, the American Health Care Act. For instance, we know there will be high-risk pools for those who can't get or can't afford insurance. And we want to take a deeper dive into that pool with Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News in Washington. Julie, I bet no one has said that to you yet. Let's dive into the high-risk pool.
Oh, why not?
And can we start with some definitions? Because it was very confusing at the end of last week. We got conflicting messages about people with pre-existing conditions. We heard the House Republican plan says insurers can charge them more but not deny coverage. Then we heard they could be denied coverage, for instance, if those pre-existing conditions were one of the essential benefits insurers will be allowed to drop, like, let's say, pregnancy coverage or mental health. Then you could be denied because the benefit is denied or could be denied. You say what? Can you be denied?
Well, it depends on your definition of deny.
Okay.
There's obviously a lot of disagreement parsing this language. Basically, the way it works is that they added an amendment to an amendment, which is part of why it's so confusing. The conservative Republicans really, really wanted to get rid of a lot of the regulations that the Affordable Care Act put in. And in the end, what they agreed to do was let states waive some of those requirements. So some of the requirements that states could waive if they wanted to include not being able to charge people more if they have pre-existing conditions and those essential benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what the Republicans are saying is that those people would still be able to get coverage, but they might not necessarily be able to get coverage for the condition that they have. And they could also be charged more.
Mm-hmm.
So if
mm-hmm.
you can't afford it, are all of those things a denial? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah. So you could not afford it and therefore you would not be able to get it. But you also could be in a state that's going to waive the requirement and you might not be able to get it in that way. So that brings us to these pools, these high-risk pools. We know that they're for people in the individual markets whose insurance lapses and then they either can't afford or they're in a state that doesn't offer certain coverage. First of all, why would someone's insurance lapse? I've heard people say that's something you pay attention to.
It is something you pay attention to. But insurance, as we know, which is why we're talking about this, is really expensive. And mm-hmm. frequently what happens is you have job-based insurance and you're doing fine. And then you get very sick and maybe you can't work anymore. And when you lose your job-based insurance, you're eligible for something called COBRA continuation, where you pay the entire premium. And often people are kind of shocked to discover that their employer's been paying a lot of that premium. And now they're sick and they really can't work and they can't afford that premium. That's one of the main reasons that people's insurance lapses. But what the effort here is to get people to have insurance when they're healthy so that when they get sick, they will have been paying
right.
premiums. And that's the reason for that, saying that, it's only if your insurance lapses.
Right. Well, and as you just explained, that could happen to people know people that's happened to. So here comes this pool, this high-risk pool that these people will then go into. Here's how House Speaker Paul Ryan described these pools in January. He was asked about insurance by a man who had cancer. So it was in his past or pre-existing condition. Here's Ryan on CNN.
About 8% of all the people under 65 have that kind of pre-existing condition. So by financing state high-risk pools to guarantee people get affordable coverage when they have a pre-existing condition like yourself, what you're doing is you're dramatically lowering the price of insurance for everybody else.
Okay, take two things there. First of all, how does it dramatically, in the Republican plan, how does that lower the price of insurance for everyone else?
Well, it clearly would. That's the idea. Right now, one of the things that raised insurance premiums in this individual market where people buy their own coverage is allowing in people who are sick, and they're expensive. And to cover those people's costs, insurers raised prices on everyone. And part of the problem is that there are not enough healthy people to offset the sick. So if you take the sick people out of the pool and once again only have healthy people in the individual market, it would definitely bring premiums down. There's a debate about how much, but it clearly would lower premiums for the healthy people left in the market. The question then is what to do with the sick people who need coverage.
Well, and they suggest these high-risk pools. That brings us to, is it true that, as Republicans say, these pools work? Here is Paul Ryan. He's talking on ABC's This Week. He's saying that these high-risk pools, which we had, we should say, before Obamacare. This is what happened, you know, before Obamacare put everybody in the same pool. There were these high-risk pools. And Paul Ryan claimed they did work in some states. Let's listen.
In Wisconsin, we had a really successful high-risk pool. 10% of the people in the individual market in Wisconsin were in the state high-risk pool. They had 8 or 9 plans to choose from. They could go to any doctor in any hospital they wanted. And their premiums and copays were cheaper than they were under Obamacare today.
So, Julie Rovner, what's the problem?
Well, Wisconsin's pool was, for a high-risk pool, relatively successful, but it did have higher premiums than were in the rest of the individual market. It had a 6-month waiting period before you could get covered for the very condition that got you into the pool. So if you had diabetes and needed to go into the pool, then you would have to wait 6 months to get coverage. Excuse me. And it had a $2 million cap, which meant that once you exceeded that, it didn't pay at all. It was funded by those higher premiums and by assessments on insurance companies. But, you know, there were some analysts in Wisconsin who said that, yeah, well, it covered 20,000 people. There were another 500,000 people who needed coverage and couldn't get it. And that was typical in the 35 states that had high-risk pools, is that for the people they served, they were kind of okay, but lots of people couldn't get in. In Florida, they closed their risk pool to new entrants in 1991, and it never reopened.
Yeah. So, and many of us have done stories on people who crossed state lines, moved with sick relatives to states that might have a better, you know, a better economy and maybe a better high-risk pool to get better health care. Look, Republicans are already facing some pushback on the House bill. At a town hall meeting last Friday, Representative Raul Labrador of Idaho was jeered when, you know, he answered a constituent. Let's listen.
You are mandating people on Medicaid except dying. You are making a mandate.
No one wants anybody to die. You know, that line is so indefensible. Nobody dies because they don't have access to health care.
But, Julie, you know, we just heard that in the past, people couldn't get, they had to wait 6 months to get into high-risk pools. Can you answer for us definitively? Have people died in the U.S. before Obamacare because they didn't have access to health care?
Well, the Institute of Medicine rather famously estimated in 2002 that 18,000 people a year died for lack of health insurance. But that's not actually what Congressman Labrador was talking about. He said later what he was talking about was emergency room care, and it's worth talking about that too. This is a 1986 law called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, and what it says is that if you need emergency treatment, you can go to a hospital. They must treat you. They can send you a bill, and they will send you a bill, and it'll be a big bill. And his point was that nobody sort of gets hit by a truck and doesn't get care because they can go to the emergency room. What they don't say is that if you have something that might kill you but is not an emergency situation, if you have cancer and you need chemotherapy, if you have diabetes and you need insulin, those things are not things that you go to the emergency room for, and those are the things that people need health insurance for. So I think, you know, even the idea that you can always go to the emergency room isn't necessarily always the case.
Look, Newt Gingrich said the same thing over the weekend responding to Jimmy Kimmel's passion plea last week when his newborn was born with a congenital heart defect. Newt Gingrich said over the weekend, no infant newborn will ever go without emergency care. But Kimmel's point was, what happens when that child is 10? You know, what happens, as you've said, when it's not as, you know, acute but ongoing? Look, in addition to these traditional high-risk pools, there's another risk pool that's being offered in the Republican plans, a virtual high-risk pool. We can talk about that another time. But Julie Rovner, if the problem overall is that not enough young, healthy people are buying insurance, why not create a plan where they have to?
Well, that's what the Affordable Care Act does. And there is, in fact, a catastrophic-only plan in the Affordable Care Act if you're under 30 that very few people know about. You know, it's sort of karma here. The Democrats had a lot of trouble explaining what was in the Affordable Care Act, and it was pretty easy to demagogue. The exact thing is happening in reverse to the Republicans now. They've taken something that was complicated. They've continued to keep it complicated. They're having trouble explaining it, and now the Democrats are pouncing on them.
Well, and so are Republicans, who are saying that they never wanted to repair Obamacare. There is an arm of the party that doesn't want to say everyone will be covered. We're going to take that up at another time. Julie Rovner, though, thanks for the swim in the high-risk pool. You really explained it to us. Chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We'll have you back as always. Thanks as always.
Of course.
How much does birth order impact your personality? A lot, according to a new study. Researchers have found that children born first are more likely than their younger siblings to become CEOs or government officials. Joining us to discuss is firstborn Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we'll get to you and your firstborn story in a minute, but first tell us about this research.
Yeah, there's long been this idea that older and younger siblings have certain characteristics that might be explained by genetics or environment. The stereotype, I think, has been that older siblings are a little bit smarter, a little bit more organized, and younger siblings are a little more wayward or more experimental. This study, which looked at registry data of Swedish men, found that, yes, indeed, these stereotypes do hold up in the data. Firstborn children are 30% more likely to be top managers. Later-born children are much more likely to be self-employed. Older siblings tend to be more natural leaders. They have more leadership ability, more social ability than their younger siblings.
So do you fit this mold?
I do not. I can imagine some listeners thinking, you know, these surveys don't describe my family, and I'll level with them. They don't describe my family either. My sister, who's 2.5 years younger, much more organized than I am, much more type A, has much better habits. So my theory had always been, before I sort of dipped into this data, what I called the first pancake theory, the idea that the first pancake is always a little bit messed up, and then you sort of master the pour and the flip, and the later pancakes turn out better. But now, having spent a lot of time with this data, both in Sweden and in the U.S. in these international surveys, it turns out that people are not pancakes. Pancakes get better as they go, but there seem to be clear benefits to being a firstborn.
Now, this isn't the first time that researchers have looked into this very issue. There's been a lot of research on how firstborns differ from later kids. Aside from job outcomes, what does the data tell us about firstborns?
Yeah, international surveys seem to find that firstborns around the world have higher IQs. They perform better in school. They're considered more accomplished by their parents. And in case you're thinking, well, that's just, you know, their parents' evaluation. Well, no. Even when researchers evaluate them, firstborns tend to have higher educational attainment, higher earnings. They stay in school longer. They earn more. They even have higher IQ. They're likely to be healthier. And this study that looked in, that looked at Swedish registry data found that, you know, it's not just the cognitive abilities that decline with birth order. It's non-cognitive abilities too. Firstborns seem to be more emotionally stable and, as I said, have better leadership ability. So across the board, really, it found a lot of advantages to being a firstborn child.
What are the theories about why?
There are a lot. And let me boil it down into two words: attention and competition. Attention is the idea that earlier born siblings enjoy more time, care, and attention than later born siblings, simply because attention for later born siblings is divided between fewer kids. It's possible that the parents themselves just get a little bit lazy, that they sort of, they have the first child, they buy 100 books, they're freaked out about making sure that it turns out perfectly, they commit to memory the first chapter of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. But by the second or third child, they've sort of chilled out a little bit, and they feel like they know how to do this. The second theory, though, which I find really interesting and sort of economic in a way, is a theory of competition. It's this idea that older and younger kids play specific roles in the family, and older siblings often have to teach their younger brothers and sisters how to behave, and this sort of instills in them a sense of leadership. Mm. Younger siblings, however, have to compete a little bit more for their parents' attention. By definition, they're competing amongst lots of children. And as a result, they have to learn how to be a little bit more sociable, a little more easygoing, a little more innovative about filling that niche. And as a result, they might be more likely to go into self-employed occupations rather than clear leadership roles.
Is it possible, though, that there's something genetic going on, that the firstborn child is getting something that the others are not?
Yeah, the short answer to this question is that they have tested this a lot, but it seems like this is a nurture rather than a nature thing. They've tested the role of biology on personality differences, but this effect, this birth order effect, appears to be driven almost exclusively by environmental factors. That is to say, the situation of having older siblings or having parents whose attention is divided among many, many kids.
And getting all hand-me-downs if you are not exactly, the firstborn right. child. What does this tell us more broadly, Derek, about what impacts a child as he or she is growing up?
Yeah, I think the implications here are sneakily profound. You know, we know that children have what developmental psychologists sometimes call a sensitive period, where they are extremely sensitive to their environments. This is true for exposure to lead. It's true for the impact of divorces among young kids, on violence in neighborhoods with young children. That when we're extremely young, we are unbelievably sensitive to our environments, and that sensitivity can play an enormous role on how we behave later in life, the occupations we go into, the amount of money that we make, the sort of people that we become, the personalities that we develop. And so it seems like simply having an older brother or having a younger sister at the age of 4, 5, 6 might make an enormous difference on sort of interpersonal intelligence, how we see ourselves in the world and the niche we try to make of it.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, I'm a second child, so none of that applies to me. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And this note, the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is hearing arguments on President Trump's revised travel ban today. NPR's Carrie Johnson will report on the proceedings later today on All Things Considered. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and I was second, too, and I've never gotten over it.
We're always going to be number two, Robin.
We're number two. It's Here Now.